listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Good evening. I'm Maureen Moore, the Associate Director of the Aloud series of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Tonight's program is a conversation moderated by Danny Fisher between Mr. Jeff Bridges and Bernie Glassman. And I think it's time to call out the dude and the Zen master. Let's welcome Jeff Bridges, Bernie Glassman, and Danny Fisher.
Can we take our shoes off?
Of course not.
You don't have to take off.
My cold feet.
Yeah, but I.
So before we start, Jeff and Bernie and I were talking beforehand, and we may mix up the rule book a little bit and sort of stop and do some audience interactive stuff after a few questions. So we're playing with the rules. I don't know how Walter Sobchak would feel about that, but we'll just go ahead and see what happens. So when I first accepted the offer to moderate, Louise Steinman at Aloud asked me, are you a Big Lebowski person? And I am a Lebowski, very, very, very much so, and I suspect a lot of people are. And it's fascinating to me that the movie has had this cult following. It's essentially a kind of spoof of a Raymond Chandler story with a character, the dude, at the center of it, who's essentially like the Philip Marlowe detective, but stoned all the time. And, and all of the characters, I mean, I think one thing that kind of characterizes them is that they're all pretty remarkably stupid. So that's it's a really interesting thing that it's had this life in terms of books. We were talking about Lebowski Fest in the back and some of these other things. So I guess we'll start there. What is it about this movie? And
I think it's a movie that, like you said, most of the characters are stupid. That's something we can all relate to. That might be it.
Yeah.
I've been wondering about that. You pointed that out. That's pretty good. I like that.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. You know, I belong to this thing called the Zen Peacemakers, and the first tenet of the Zen Peacemakers is not knowing. I guess we could have called it be stupid. Maybe I'll go home and rewrite it.
But you, Jeff, what do you think about the fact that it's kind of an unusual movie that's taken on this life where people love it the way they're
so loved. Surprising.
Yeah.
When it first came out, I was surprised that it wasn't really received that well here in America. Because we sure had a good time making it, and when I saw the finished product, I was bowled over. Those guys, the Coen brothers, they're real master filmmakers. But it had to go over, and I think it did a bit better in Europe, and then it came and splashed back on our shores, and people started to really kind of dig it, and they did this, they have this strange thing, Lebowski Fests. Has anybody here been to a Lebowski Fest? Yeah, which I went to one. Man, I had my Beatle moment. I got my band, the Abiders, together. And I came out as, and played to a sea of dudes. They were all dressed in bathrobes and, you know, their sweaters, and it was amazing. So it's, yeah, it's a phenomenon, man. It's amazing.
And it's interesting in terms of you. I've heard other actors refer to you as dude. Your band is called The Abiders. So it's your relationship with the character is interesting.
Yeah, it's got this weird momentum thing going. And then Bernie, you know, he comes up to me one day and says, you realize that in many Buddhist circles, the dude is considered a Zen master. I said, what are you talking about? You know, there was no talk of Buddhism, spirituality, nothing like that, you know. And he says, oh, yeah. He said, you know, the Koan brothers? Come on. And then he goes on, he says, oh, it's chock full of koans, man. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, like, you know, the dude abides. You know, new shit has come to light. Shut the fuck up, Donnie. Yeah. So then he says, hey, you want to write a book about that? I said, oh, okay, yeah. We get to hang out a little bit, do some, you know, teaching and stuff. So that was, it's been a gas for me, you know, that momentum of the movie. And, you know, and now here we are doing this. I mean, it's, you know, and you don't know how it's going to roll. Now I did this band. I wanted to call our band The Royal We. That was my choice. But they, you know, my steel player said, no, The Abiders, man. Come on, The Abiders. I said, okay.
Well, and Bernie, writing the book, it's interesting that there's been a kind of a rash of writing lately about Buddhism and the movies. People writing about Groundhog Day and the Dharma, Star Wars and the Dharma, The Matrix and the Dharma. And now you're kind of putting your foot in that area of kind of talking about the path and a movie. What's there for you that's fruitful?
Well, of course, from my standpoint, everything is Dharma. So, and. The word Dharma is understood by different people or misunderstood by different people or not understood at all by many people. And when I first saw The Big Lebowski, it came out in 98. I probably saw it in 99. I didn't see it in the movies. I saw it on DVD. I think there were DVDs. So that's like 40 years after I started getting involved in Zen. I got involved in 58, started being involved in Zen. And what I realized by that time is that there was a lot of words that people use, like Dharma, that are used to I'm not sure if people understood what they were saying when they said Dharma or Buddha Dharma or enlightenment or all these different terms. And now what I was seeing in Lebowski movie, in The Big Dude, is terminology that was dealing with the same issues that we deal in formal Zen training, but in a language that anybody can understand. So if the Shakyamuni Buddha talked about everything has changed, now I think that's somewhat understandable, but new shit comes to light is much more understandable. Much more understandable. Or there's things like, there's this guy Nagarjuna that would negate everything that you said, or a guy named Toksan would hit you with a stick if you say a word, you know, and if you didn't say the right word, or whatever you said, he would hit you with a stick. But shut the fuck up, Donnie. I mean, it's doing the same thing. The biggest thing, which I use a lot now, is, you know, like, that's just your opinion, man. And what's beautiful about that, I don't care what religion or non-religion or what walk of life you come from, if you can really grasp that, accept that, that's the end of all wars. If we could share our opinions and not try to convince the other person that you got to have my opinion or I'm going to kill you. And that's going on around the world and going on in this country. But I work around the world. That's going on all over the place. I got to kill you if you don't accept my opinion, because my opinion is the right one. Imagine if you could be like the dude and say, you know, like man, that's just your opinion. In fact, recently I've started saying something which many people call me a little bit of a heretic or irreverent. I don't know if you've ever been called irreverent, but I have. So I have this boss. His name is Shakyamuni Buddha. He lived a long time ago, but he's still my boss. And many people talk, and I'm sure you're involved in college. I'm sure you teach the Four Noble Truths. I call it the Four Noble Opinions. And that, for me, is Zen.
Thank you. It's interesting that in the book you discuss a few of your movies and what you learned working with other actors, with directors, with writers. One movie of yours that you didn't discuss that I thought was particularly relevant to this book, and as it turns out, it's one of Louise's favorite movies too, is Fearless. Mm. It was just mentioned in the New York Times Magazine this past week, and curious, with all this stuff about mindfulness of death and that film, what was that, making that film and that process like for you? And did you ever think of it?
Oh, yeah, it was a wonderful, we had a wonderful time on that. Peter Weir is, you know, great director, and I enjoyed working with him so much. And he was so inclusive. You know, there's some directors, great directors, who, you know, have a very solid way, you know, their opinion, you know, and they want you to carry out their opinion, you know. Other guys, like Peter, are, you know, go into it not knowing, you know, and yet he really made a point of saying, I need you. I need all of your ideas, man. You know, we may not agree, but we're flying this ship together, you know. We're in this together. And he encouraged me and everyone in the show to give everything. You know, he wanted all of the stuff, and then he got to, you know, mix it. And one of the things that he did that was so wonderful was every day he would score the day. He would bring music in and play the vibe, you know, that he wanted everyone to kind of, you know, be in on. So that was great for an actor to have, you know, if we were doing a scene, you know, Isabel Rossellini, you know, so she was so great to work with, and we were doing a very intimate scene. He would have this music playing that would, without saying any words, get everyone, all the, you know, the grips and the gaffers, all in on it together. So we all felt like, you know, we were together on it, and it was just a great, great experience. I mean, you know, when you ask me questions, my mind just, you know, riffles through all these different, you know, I can, like, one thing that comes to mind, I think it's probably the best use of music in a movie, that last, I think it's, pronounced it Gorky, is that how you pronounce it, the composer, you know, and there's just that opening, you know, the guy when he eats the strawberry and he's kind of feeling his mortality, and I remember shooting that scene, and Peter said to me, I'm going to torture you now. I said, what do you mean, man? He says, I'm going to torture you. This is going to be very painful for you. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, we're going to do this scene over and over and over and over and over and over. I said, oh, stop. Okay, what do you know? He says, you know, you'll see. Now lie down there and eat that strawberry. And so I did it, and it's one of these shots, you know, where the camera's up here and it goes down like this and twists and it takes, you know, about maybe four times as long as I'm doing it, and then it's like, okay, reset, okay. And it's this, you know, tremendous emotional thing of, you know, dying and being born all at the same, you know, very, you know, over and over, he wanted me to get into that not knowing place, you know, because he probably knew, that, you know, most actors, this actor, this is how I kind of work. I'll get in my hotel room and I'll learn my lines and prepare the scene, what, you know, my opinion of how it should go. And I might have a few opinions, four or five. And he wanted, he liked that. But then he wanted to have something else happen. You know, he wanted to let all of the environment kind of inform what we were doing. And I often think he probably used the first take. But, you know, that was a great experience. That's a wonderful movie. I love that movie.
Thank you. It's interesting, you know, when you talked about your films and you talked about some of the work that you did, there was a conversation in the book about blurring the line between sort of work and play. And Jeff, you had a word you made up, plorking, for that. And Bernie used row, row your boat as sort of a teaching tool, almost. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you probably have heard of that ditty, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream.
Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Let's do a round.
Yeah. row, row your boat
gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
So, in Buddhism, I'll give you some technical terms, and then we'll get back to the non-technical terms. There's something called paramitas. There are different ways that one can practice. There's a paramita of giving, and you're all going to give for the library. There's a paramita of wisdom. There's a paramita of patience. And those are the ores. So as we go down the stream, we choose ores, and people choose different kind of ores. So row, row, row your boat. Another way of talking about that kind of practice instead of on a boat is keep on trucking, man. You know, that's keep on doing. Choose your ores. But it's extremely important that it first of all be done merrily. I was born into a Jewish family. I'm Jewish, and I'm Buddhist. And many times I get asked, "What did Judaism bring to Buddhism?" And I said, "A sense of humor." And one of the practices that I gave Jeff, we've been rapping together and hanging together and burning cigars together for about 15 years, 10, 15 years. One of the practices is every morning, wake up, look in the mirror, and laugh. You know. So merrily is very important, and it's not necessarily taught in many of the Dharma centers, but I think it's very important. And the last, gently down the street, gently. I come from a very macho tradition, and gently is very important. So that sums up a lot of what this is all about, you know. Keep on trucking, man, but do it merrily and gently. Mm.
Do you want to say anything about plorking?
Plorking? I like warlay, too. Oh, let's see. It's from what Bernie was saying, merrily, and being my father's son. My dad, you know, taught me most of the... Am I hung up here, man? What's going on here? Is this good? That's all right. Is it? What's happening here? My dad taught me. I mean, it was maybe it's got a little chilly. Is it cold out there or is it no? Is it, no, it's a little bit. Well, I'm going to take this off for a second. Is it all right? Okay. And so my dad, probably of all the things he taught me, and he taught me basically all the basics of acting, and the thing that I treasure most, it was nothing that he actually said to me, but just observing him. I got to work with him as a kid quite often. You know, if you see a little chubby 8-year-old kid on Sea Hunt, that's probably me, you know. Unlike a lot of entertainers, he encouraged all his kids to go into showbiz. He loved it so much, all the different aspects, kind of what we're doing now, you know, signing autographs. He loved the work. And I also got to work with him as an adult in Blown Away and Tucker. And what I noticed as an adult, I kind of noticed a little bit more, but I noticed the joy in which he approached the work, and it was really wild, man. It was like a contagious thing when he came out on the set to you know, work. He gave this vibe that this is fun, man. This is like, you know, advanced pretend, you know, when you're a kid. You know, hey, we get the planks, and we get all the cool stuff, man, and all the cool kids, you know. And everybody said, oh, yeah, that's right. It was kind of contagious. It would ripple through. And everyone is, you know, merry. And when you're kind of merry, you're kind of relaxed. And when you're relaxed, you know, the good stuff gets to, you know, manifest. It comes out that way. So, you know, that's you know, he plorked big time.
We don't.
A master plorker.
It's interesting. It's interesting that you mentioned your dad, because one of the things I wanted to ask you guys, the most affecting parts of the book for me were when, particularly you, Jeff, talked about your families. You write really, or you speak beautifully about your wife, Sue, and how you met her and sort of how your relationship works. And it seems like there's not a whole lot of great information about, yet, about relationships and family life and practice, and I would sort of say the moments where you spoke about Eve as well, that would be something I'd want to preserve for a time capsule on sort of relationships and being on the path. And I was curious to have you guys say a little bit more about family life and the path.
Yeah, well, so my opinion. when I first got involved in Zen, I was somewhat of a hippie, and my wife and I were actually looking to start or to be involved in a commune, and we were actually interviewing folks and can we live together, you know, be a commune. And then I got very heavily involved in Zen Center, my teacher, and it took me a while before I realized that what I had entered into was a monastic scene, not a family scene, and it didn't relate really for a family scene. But Buddhism, I think, has now moved to where the issues of family and relationship are much more important. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for that. Yeah. I mean, relationship is all there is.
Mm.
You know, we talk about the interconnectedness of life. That's nothing but relationship. We're relating to everything, but it. So the sense of monastic is almost like not dealing with all those relations. And you can't, in my opinion, you can't really grok the interconnectedness of life without realizing that everything is relationship. No. So I'm looking forward. I'm getting on in my years. I'm looking forward to the unfolding of what that will mean in the practice.
Yeah, marriage. What a great deal. You know, to be married to life, kind of. You know, to have the same kind of relationship with everything. I was scared. Literally to death of getting married. My wife doesn't like me to say that. I think she's kind of used to it now, but it's just, you know, again, she's used to my opinions. And my opinion was that the fear of marriage, and probably a lot of you guys, I don't know, maybe you know, several guys I've talked to have had the same feeling, that you're scared of marriage, but what that fear really is the scare of death. This is my theory anyway. If death is the kind of the end of the story, you know, how everything works out, marriage is a giant step in that direction. You know, here is the woman I'm going to spend the rest of my life with, you know. No more girls, man. No more screwing around. No, come on. I really dug that, you know. But what you don't realize, you know, when you finally, you know, I finally got with the program, when you open that marital door and not just do it in kind of a gesture, you know, that's the way I first did it. But when you get with the program, you realize that door opens to this wonderful hallway with all these other great doors in it that you would never be, you know, privy to if you didn't open that initial door of marriage, you know, and saying, you know, we are one. You know, marriage, it's like, That's the essence of the other thing that's not you, and it's, you know, this, you know, a woman, you know, like, God, I can't do all those things that you do, and, you know, it's something so, you know, wonderful about that. Sue and I, let me just back up and just kind of tell you how that worked out. Sue said to me, you know, after we'd lived together for about 3 years, and it was kind of do your business or get off the pot. You know, I mean, you know, you kind of know by that time. And, you know, we had broken up several times and got back together. And finally she said to me, in the most not guilt-provoking way, but just very straight, and she said, you know, I really understand all this ambivalence and stuff that you got. But I'm gonna head back up to Montana where you found me because my biological clock's going off. I want to have a real relationship, and that's what I'm gonna do. And I said, oh God. I just thought of something else. About a year before this moment, we're living in, you gotta stop me because I can go on and on about it. But about a year before that, we're living in my bachelor pad in Malibu, and across this little kind of a valley, and there's another mountain over there, and the mountain is very volatile, so there's no houses on it because it's, you know, the ground is kind of, you know, not real stable. But there is, right smack in the middle of this mountain, is a head about the size of this stage. A big rock, and it looks like the head in Zardoz. You ever see Zardoz? And it's got two big eyes and a nose and a mouth, a cave like that. And as the sun would go across the sky, the expression would kind of change, you know. Like it. And I said to Sue, you know, one day we got to go over there and sit in that guy's mouth. You know, I bet there's petroglyphs in there and all kinds of cool things. Chumash, that must be a power spot, you know. So she said, okay. So one day we took our dogs. And just like the crow flies, there was no path or anything. We just went through the sagebrush and went down through there and got up into this guy's mouth a lot faster than we thought it would take. And I'm sitting in there, and I'm looking at the petroglyphs, and there's nothing, and the dogs are, you know, like this. And I sit down, and I say, wow, this is really something. And I look over at our place, and it's a mountain, and there were no other houses around. And our little house is just sitting on there. I said, God, isn't that something? It's so beautiful, you know. Our little house sitting on this dust speck hurling through space, you know, like that. And all of a sudden, I get this feeling, this thing coming up my ass, up my spine, through my heart. My tears start to ejaculate out of my eyes. And she goes, what's wrong? Nothing. And what I'm feeling is,
You will now ask this woman to marry you. She's coming up to them, like this. And she says, what's wrong? And I say, nothing. She goes, tell me. And I say, I have this terrible feeling that I'm supposed to ask you to marry me now, and I'm just scared, so shit. You know, she goes, well, you don't have to do that. I say, good, let's get the fuck out of here. So about a year later, she says to me, you know, I dig where you're coming from, but this is what I'm doing. So I got down on my knees, and I said, okay, will you marry me, and let's do it, you know, Thursday. This is Monday, because I don't know how long I can hold this together. And I gave myself this little out. I said, hey, Jeff, you know, this girl, you love her so much, and you know that. That's, you know, evident. You sat in that guy's mouth and that thing. You know the universe is, you know, with you. And, you know, if you don't marry this woman, you know, can you imagine, you know, being an old guy and saying, that was the one. So the out I gave myself was, look, just do it, Jeff, and if it doesn't work, get a divorce. You know, people, that's what divorce is for, get a divorce. So that's what I did, and now we cut to our honeymoon at the Seven Sacred Pools in Maui, overlooking these beautiful, you know, gorgeous place, and I'm just smelling the rotten mangoes, and I'm just pouting. Ugh. And Sue looks at me, she says, let's annul this. This is ridiculous. I said, no, no, no. And she put up with that shit for about 2 years. And thank God she didn't kick me to the curb and she hung in with me, because now we've been married 35 years and it just gets better and better and better. And like I was saying, you know, before, marriage, you know, this union and this opportunity to have the other right there in front of you is in a living fashion. And Sue and I, every once in a while, we just had one just recently that I call our ancient battle, our, you know, primal war. And usually kind of what it is down, kind of you could distill it down, is it's usually something like, you don't get it. you don't understand, you know, where I'm coming from, you know. And I thought about that for a while, and I said, you know, that's really true, and you don't understand me, and I never will fully understand you. And isn't it wonderful that we have that in common? You know? And we'll often, when we get in these primal things, sometimes we'll just sit opposite each other, and we'll just, you know, I'll rap, say all my stuff, and she just listens, you know, not trying to figure out what she's going to say to put her side. And then I'll just listen and get her thing, and then she's, you know. Actually, it's bearing witness, man, isn't it? That's me. And all of a sudden, out of this, we don't get any kind of answer like, oh, I understand where you're coming from. It's nothing like that. But all of a sudden, what kind of surfaces in the most natural way is just love with these opposite feelings. And it just, and it's a, and that, and then, you know, well, you know what you do then.
So I'll tell you another little, I want to say secret. It's not a secret, but it's important. A deep Dharma opinion. In this movie, The Big Lebowski, you probably heard of this movie. There's this movie in the beginning of the movie, somebody comes in and pees on a rug.
Oh, right? I loved it, yes.
And it turns out that that rug really ties the room together, does it not? So it's a very important rug. So within Buddhism is about realizing the interconnectedness of life. That means it's about finding out the rug that really ties the room together. The room being our life, right? And what is that rug? He was just talking about it. It's love. Love is the rug that ties the room together. So now, in case you ever get involved in a koan study involving the koans of the Big Lebowski, and if somebody ties the room together, you already have the answer. But the point of koan study, of course, is that you can't just repeat an answer. You got to manifest love. Now imagine if we all did that. Imagine if the world manifested love. Could you imagine? I work in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine. Could you imagine if what was manifested was love? Or within our family? Now that's the rub, man.
We should take care to, I think, involve the audience at this point. And maybe while people are getting organized to ask questions, I'm not sure where the mics will be. Let's see.
Is there a mic in the room?
Back there, thank you. I'll just ask one quick question that Louise wanted me to ask you guys. You talk a lot about social action and sort of contemplate social responsibility a bit in the book, and LA is a really interesting place to do that. We're a stone's throw from Skid Row, which is the largest stable homeless population in the entire country. I want to ask you guys, because of your interest in homelessness, Bernie, and hunger, Jeff, what's something all of us can do to sort of benefit our suffering brothers and sisters, or the people you dedicate the books to, all of the hungry spirits?
Well, you know, I remember once I was giving a talk in Central Park in New York, and I was talking about socially engaged Buddhism. Remember those Change Your Mind days?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was talking about socially engaged Buddhism. And somebody asked me, and I took the mic and I put it on myself and I started walking. I like to do that. I walked around the crowd talking, you know. And somebody said, you know, there's so much going on. I don't know what to do. How do I get involved in socially engaged work? You know, so I said, Jeff, this is Mary. I mean, so I met a person, the person that asked me the question, and next to it was an old woman. I said, this is Mary. Why don't you say hello? And then I said, well, why don't you ask her this, how you feel? And then I said, why don't you ask, is there anything I can do for you? And then Mary and Jeff start hugging each other, and they start talking. Isn't that enough?
Yeah.
So wherever you are, I mean, somebody falls in the street, pick them up. A kid cries, you hold it. You don't have to go looking. There are things that will come to you as it's the cries of the universe, and you take care because it's you that's crying. It's not the other that's crying. You know?
I just had this flash as you were talking about that, and having just told my marital trip and my, you know, the fear of death and all that, and the protection of the so-called self, you know, your autonomy. You know, that's what marriage. The fear of marriage is, I'll lose that. Now I'll have to have a partner who's gonna have to. And there's a tremendous fear. And I just noticed kind of a similarity between those things, engaging socially. You'll say, oh, that's going to take time away from the stuff that I want to do. It's going to, you know, spread, you know, I'll spread myself too thin. And I dance with that in my social work with hunger, you know. I remember when I first got made aware of the enormous problem of world hunger and how it wasn't a matter that there wasn't enough food or there wasn't enough money or even knowledge about how to end hunger. There are countries that had done it, so we know how to do it. The main problem was the political will that they just, but that there wasn't strong enough to end the problem. And then, of course, the politicians are supposed to represent us, so then it gets down to, well, you know, my will, you know. And when I learned all the facts about it, then I was asked, so what are you willing to do now? Are you not just making a gesture, you know, like giving, you know, $10 or something like that to, you know, scratch the guilt itch, but something that kind of fits in with your life that you do sort of naturally, that you can just, you know, make a little adjustment. Could you guys be quiet in there? You're on the wings. You're kind of, it's distracting me. Sorry, I wish it didn't distract me, but it does. Sorry, guys. I had this, one of my favorite guys is Bucky Fuller, you know. He had this great, what a wonderful guy, you know, came up with, one of his terms that he came up with that I just love is trim tabbing. And what a trim tab is, the engineers of, you know, the big ocean-going vessels, they discovered that it took too much energy to use the, you know, this big rudder to turn the ship. So these engineers came up with a little rudder that goes on the big rudder called a trim tab. And so the trim tab turns the rudder, and then the rudder turns the ship. And Bucky said that's the way the individual affects society, like a trim tab. As a matter of fact, that's on his gravestone. Call me Trim Tab. That's what he's got on there. And that's what all of us are. We all can make little adjustments, and we're not going to do it perfect. You know, we're not going to be Jesus Christ. You know, we're not light beings yet. You know, we have, you know, we struggle with this stuff, man, you know. But to just realize that that's what we, you know, that's our power. We're connected. You know, we're all connected to other people. You know, we inspire each other, and that's how we turn in the direction we want to head. And my recent work is ending childhood hunger, and of course that, you know, children, that's just the tip of the iceberg. But I think it's a good handle, because you know, the well-being of our children, it's a great compass to figure out, are we heading in the right direction? And another reason that sorry, it'll come to me. It'll come to me. You know, I just got back from New York. That's why that was a little sad. Is it guys taking pictures? Not in the pictures. God, isn't that weird? I'm just like, I'm an actor, bird. You know, so I feel we're all in this together. So, you know, we're all doing so little sounds. You know, I'm sorry. You know, but that's just the way it goes. I mean, and see, I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out here in a second. What was that? Because it was something I really wanted to say. And let me see, what the hell was it? It was, oh, shit. Well, maybe it'll come back. I don't know.
If it comes to you, it'll come back to me.
It'll come back.
As soon as we let it go and move on, it's going to pay it.
This is a good lead-in segue to me to tell you one of the secrets, another secret of Zen. I'm now in my mid-70s. And as I read in my earlier days, I would read about Zen. And one of the big things was all these masters, old Zen teachers, saying that you had to live in the moment. And then I finally got to the place where I realized what they were saying. They were these old guys like me, and they couldn't remember anything else. So now you know another secret of
being living in the present.
In the present.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll just end there. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm sorry, Bernie and Jeff will be signing books outside, but I'm getting the
no questions, man. We passed the question part.
Did we go right through the question part?
I think we did. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe we'll take one or two questions. Do you guys want to do it popcorn style, or you want people to come up to the mics, or what would you?
Yell might be quicker. Maybe just yell out.
Do popcorn if you could scream loud enough.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello.
I'll repeat it.
Oh man, yeah. Oh man.
The question is about Jeff's mother.
About my mom. She was like probably the best actor of the whole family, and I could talk hours about her. But what popped into my mind as you said it was a wonderful thing that she used to do for all her kids. It was something called time. And every day she would spend an hour with each of her kids and just be totally focused and do whatever that kid wanted to do. You know, so if I said, okay, Mom, let's, today we're going to play a spaceship. You be the space lady in the under the table there, and I'll be the alien, let's go into your makeup thing. I'm going to make you up like a clown, and that kind of thing. And then later as a teenager, it would be, massage me, Mom. But it was a time where she wouldn't answer. The phone rang, and I'm having my time with Jeff. No, I'll call him back, and there was never a sense of duty. She just loved it. It was something, wonderful. So that's what sprang to mind when you mentioned my mom, and also something that she would say when I would go off to work. She would always say, remember, have fun, and don't take it too seriously. And that's powerful direction to me that I hear over and over.
Maybe you'll take another question from over here.
Oh, hello. Yeah. I was just curious. I once heard an Alan Watts lecture, and he was talking about trying not to be too attached to not being too attached.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about someone called a stone Buddha. People who are too attached to not being too attached. And I was just curious to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, man, that's something I work with all the time. I love Watts. He was like, the guy kind of led me into this this realm. But that's, it's like that perfection thing. It can just drive you absolutely crazy trying to, be that thing that you're not, and to kind of invite that in and to kind of just feel it, kind of is in the most original kind of state without all the layers on it, just, kind of and feel that discomfort and not try to get rid of it, not try to say, say, damn it, I'm going to be perfect, damn it, just to kind of accept that aspect and let it be sort of the kind of this having that same thing with the marriage, that exercise that I was doing with Sue, kind of doing that with myself, say acknowledge those feelings and letting them be and let that love will kind of naturally surface and you are where you are, and this is a groove,
I'd like to give my speak for my wife. This is my opinion of my wife. My wife is also a Zen teacher, and she calls her brain. She gave her brain a name. She calls her brain Bruno. And so, Bruno might say. And Bruno says a lot of things to her. But Bruno could say, now, Eve, or as Jeff calls her, Evie. Now, Evie, don't be attached to not being attached. And she would say, Bruno, that's just your opinion, man. So she, during the day, is telling Bruno a lot of times, hey, Bruno, that's just your opinion, man. So I would say that to you, not being attached and not being attached and not being attached. I mean, that's just an opinion, man. Once you accept everything as an opinion and you realize it's Bruno telling you these things, and just say, Bruno, that's your opinion, all of a sudden your life is going to go pretty cool.
I think we have time for one more question, and I think we'll pick from.
It's got to be the supreme question. But before that supreme question, Jeff has been telling me about this movie scene he was on.
Kevin Bacon, yeah. We just did this movie, R.I.P.D., and, you know, actors, even coming out here today, you know, I was excited and, you know, it would be fun and everything, but a little performance anxiety, you know, I gotta, you know, because you want to do a good deal, you know. And Kevin, who's a wonderful actor, and, you know, he knows that, you know, because they're kind of a fraternity feeling among actors before a scene, and it wasn't a particularly big scene, but he knew we were all actors and we all had that kind of tension, a little bit of tension going. He looked at all the actors and he said, "Remember, everything depends on this."
Yeah. So I now that. Knowing that,
yes,
ask
there you
your
go.
Final
yeah.
question, man.
Everything depends on this.
Hello, I have my question. So I have been to two Lebowski Fests, and of course I've learned about the Church of the Latter-day Dude. So I would like to know what y'all and the dude would think, what y'all think and what the dude would think of dudism.
Dudism, well, I'm sort of flabbergasted by it. The dude, he would dig it, I think. Yeah, I don't know. Supreme question, excellent question. And there it is.
That's
Oh, where are you? I'm Doodly Lama. Is that Alan out there? Hey, good. I'm glad you shouted out. Alan calls me Doodly Lama. He's my dear friend who recorded all of this book with us and took the wonderful pictures in the book. And he's my dear friend.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan. Well, can't see you.
If you're anything like me, you've probably fallen in love with these guys even more. I'm sorry we have to wrap up, but they will be signing books, so I hope you can get a chance to talk to them when they're signing. Thank you both very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.